Deutsche Welle, Living Planet.
Coming up on this week's Living Planet. It's World Water Week, the annual conference in Stockholm that focuses on the globe's water issues. This year, the emphasis is on water cooperation, building partnerships. And so this week, we're going to dedicate the entire show to that very theme. But don't worry, we're not off to the conference in rainy Sweden. Instead, we're going to spin the globe and take you as far as Australia, India, the US, and Austria. From the gambling heaven of Las Vegas, we'll hear how the city in the desert is trying to save water to make sure the glitz and glitter will continue.
Las Vegas is improving, but it's not doing a great job of water conservation.
From the Indian city of Bangalore, we'll hear how harvesting the heavens gives people a chance to manage their water problem.
The human condition is to create problems and find solutions, so there is no other option but to be optimistic.
And back in Europe, in Austria, we'll join a project on the Danube River that draws visitors from Africa to learn about water cooperation.
They are pretty good when it comes to water quality, you know, because nobody likes dirty water. There's an easy agreement saying we need to be cleaner.
You're listening to Living Planet on DW. I'm Andreas Ilmer in Bonn, and we'll hear those stories later on in the program. But as promised, we'll first take you all the way to Australia, to the Murray-Darling Basin. It's one of the most important grain production regions in the world and vital for food security. But overconsumption and low rainfall have turned the waters into a muddy sludge. After massive shortages, Australia has set out a plan to save its most important river system. Aborigines, though, who have lived for generations in the affected area, seem to have been forgotten in the consultation process. Pavel Schrey takes us down the riverbanks.
I often feel very privileged in regards to where I was born, and if you go to my birth certificate, it's got Riverbank Marukma. So, you know, I'm always so proud that my entry into this world actually began on the riverbank of the Goulburn River.
Wayne Atkinson is a senior elder of the Yorta Yorta people, an indigenous nation living on the Murray River, about 200 kilometres north of Melbourne, in Australia. Born in 1943, Uncle Wayne, as he is known, was born on the banks of one of the main tributaries of the basin.
We grew up on the river, roamed the rivers, fished the rivers, with our parents, grandparents. You know, it's your identity.
About 75,000 Aboriginal people live across the Murray-Darling Basin, a huge tangle of rivers that flow from the rugged ranges through the sunburnt plains, from Queensland in the north to the ocean in South Australia. 3,500 kilometres long, the basin extends over an area larger than France and Germany combined.
When I was growing up, the river was certainly a lot clearer than it is now. You could drink it, you'd go down and drink straight from the river. You certainly wouldn't do that now.
Settlers arrived here over a century ago and began cultivating crops. Their farming practices have intensified in recent decades. They began drawing more water from the basin and using more fertilisers and pesticides. This created a massive boom in agriculture. As Peter Hunt from the Victorian Farmers Federation explains, the Murray-Darling Basin has become a leading food-producing region.
There are 2.2 million people who are relying on that basin. We've got a huge dairy industry, rice industry, grains industry, livestock industries, cotton and so on, which are totally reliant on that system. It is our food bowl.
But the unbridled use of chemicals and excessive water consumption has had a devastating impact on the rivers, creeks, wetlands and forests. Ecosystems have completely changed, and as Juliet Lefebvre from Environment Victoria explains, native species are being pushed out.
The fish in the Murray now, 90% of them are actually introduced species. So if you catch 10 fish in the river, 9 of them will be carp or introduced species. So the native fish numbers are about 10% of what they were.
And as the farms strain the basin's water, climate change is taking a bite out of the farmlands. Temperatures are climbing and rainfall has dropped by some 40%. That means significantly less water for irrigating crops and increasing competition for resources.
Our rivers are highly resilient. They can cope with drought or they could cope with having water extracted for use. The trouble is they can't cope with both at the same time.
In 2008, the basin's 1 million-tonne rice crop failed, driving families from their farms and causing suicides at twice the national rate. The Australian rice failure drove up already unstable food prices, prompting riots around the world. Australian authorities are working on a rescue plan for the region. As they do, environmentalists are urging the government not to overlook an important resource right here in the basin.
Indigenous Australians have lived alongside the rivers and waterways in their countries for tens of thousands of years. They hold an enormous store of knowledge about the dynamics of these natural systems, which areas need water when, which species can be best protected by delivering flows in certain areas at certain times.
Will Mooney, from Friends of the Earth, works with Indigenous communities and says it is vital that the Yorta Yorta and other groups are included in water management.
For us to fail to incorporate that knowledge into water planning means that we're missing out on all that information.
Will Mooney says that although Australian river systems have adapted to drought conditions, we need to learn to share the water much better. Juliet Lefevre from Environment Victoria agrees.
I want to see a fairer sharing of water between us and the river systems on which we depend.
Back at the river, Yorta Yorta elder Wayne Atkinson also wants to see a fairer sharing of water for people and the environment, for the farmers, the wildlife and the many Indigenous people who live here.
I just wonder how much bloody worse is it going to get, particularly when you see some of the tributary systems like the Broken. It's like a drainage system now, like draining mud and slush.
He says in addition to watering farms, a healthy river is also crucial for sustaining the cultural and religious needs of his people.
So it's like a part of your blood or your identity flowing from all of those generations before you, you know, have grown and lived on the river. When I'm back on the river, I feel a sense of security because I know that all of those ancestors before me have been here. The river is part of our blood and identity as Yorta Yorta people.
Pavel Schrey, DW, in Australia's Murray-Darling Basin.
The monsoons have arrived in Bangalore, India, bringing much-needed water to the city after an 8-month dry season. But poor infrastructure and rapid urban growth mean the city's water needs still outstrip availability. DW correspondent Siri Bulusu followed a water educator through the thirsty city as he teaches locals how to harvest rainwater.
In the village of Mathakiri, located 4 hours outside Bangalore, a family of 12 watch excitedly as a woman pours herself a cup of water. They have just installed a new rainwater harvesting system. At the home is Vishwanath, a tall man with long hair and a prominent beard. Commonly known as the Zen Rain Man, he is a leading expert in rainwater harvesting. He explains to the family how to use the system, including how the water is collected and where it is stored.
People are a bit ignorant about where their water comes from, how much do they use, what is the scarcity value of water, where does it go after they use it.
And water waste isn't something Bangalore can afford. This is a thirsty city. In the past few decades, the population has grown by 7 million. And as the city expands, demand for water is growing. Right now, most people here rely on the Kaveri River for water. Modern pressurized pipelines transport the water across 120 kilometers to Bangalore, but only half the supply is accounted for. The inner city piping system is nearly 50 years old and riddled with leaks and faulty meters, thus worsening the water shortage. But Vishwanath has an idea.
Now, rainwater harvesting has great potential because what falls on the city as rain is precisely twice the amount what comes from the Kaveri River.
For the past 20 years, Vishwanath has worked closely with the Bangalore Water and Sewage Board to help solve the city's water problems. He serves as Secretary General of the International Rainwater Catchment Systems Association and runs the Rainwater Club, a public forum which educates people about the benefits of rainwater harvesting. He frequently visits households outside the water utility limits where he discusses the benefits of rainwater harvesting with families.
When it rains, if you collect water from a 100 square meter roof area, you get, on a normal rainfall, close to 2,000 liters to 3,000 liters of water. This is a fantastic supplement.
The Karnataka state government agreed. In 2004, they implemented a policy requiring new constructions to incorporate a rainwater harvesting system. But due to poor enforcement, there was little impact. The Bangalore's water utility took things further and implemented their own policy. Rainwater harvesting is now mandatory for all new constructions of 1,200 square feet and above. Bangalore's Water and Sewage Board also set up the Sri Vishwaraya Water Theme Park to help educate the public about Bangalore's water issues. 27 types of rainwater harvesting systems are displayed on a square acre of perfectly manicured lawn. Thea Jesvani is a project manager at the Water Theme Park. She is versed in every system and helps visitors choose the best system for their needs. There are dozens of different ways to collect rainwater.
You can store the water, directly reuse it whenever necessary for gardening or for car wash or somewhere in the utilities where you use water. You can put the surface tanks on a platform. You put a platform on that, you place a surface tank. You can start using this water for secondary purposes.
There are dozens of different ways to collect rainwater. The most popular model adopted is the recharge well, a 20 feet deep well which collects rainwater and sends it to an aquifer, thus mitigating urban flooding while replenishing the groundwater supply.
We have lower income people also coming here because rainwater harvesting is mandatory in the sense it's not only for bigger buildings. The regulation might say it is only for bigger buildings, but there are people who voluntarily come here to know about rainwater harvesting, though they have smaller houses.
The government does not subsidize the costs of rainwater harvesting systems for households or commercial buildings. They believe the immediate cost benefit of supplementing Kaveri River water with rainwater is sufficient. Those who fail to implement rainwater harvesting systems in their constructions are issued warnings by the police and threatened with exorbitant fines. In most cases, the warnings are enough to move people into action. But Thea Jesvani wants to see better enforcement of the new policies, because the city's water resources are overstretched.
There are some new areas where there is no drinking water at all. For such people, if you compare, rainwater is worth it for them. So when you don't have water at all, I think this is a better option for them. So spending 5,000 to 6,000 rupees is not a bigger amount for such people.
The initial cost of 5,000 or 6,000 rupees to install a rainwater harvesting system is a great investment for a household paying the same amount to a water provider every year. People are already receiving less than they need. Most people in Bangalore get only 98 liters of water per day. That's less than half the amount compared to several European countries. At a modest household outside of Bangalore, Vishwanath tells a family about his work and explains why he thinks water harvesting is so important. He believes that this is the best way to provide for the city's growing water needs.
We're currently documenting 100 success stories with water in the city of Bangalore. About 100,000 buildings are doing rainwater harvesting in Bangalore. This makes it perhaps India's second largest rainwater harvesting city, next only to Chennai, which perhaps has 500,000 rainwater harvesting structures.
Despite failing infrastructure and lagging political action, Vishwanath believes there is potential for Bangalore to become an example of sustainable water solutions in India.
The human condition is to create problems and find solutions. So there is no other option but to be optimistic. We would want each one of these people to become champions of water and for the neighbors around them to come to them and learn about it.
Siri Balusu, DW, Bangalore, India.
From Bangalore, we're off to the US now, to Las Vegas. The world's gambling capital is set right in the middle of a scorching hot desert. Water supply comes from Lake Mead and the Colorado River. In fact, the city is drinking the river dry as it tries to keep up with the demands of its casinos, golf courses and hotels. The NGO American Rivers has recently named the Colorado the most endangered waterway in America. DW's Christina Bergman hit the streets of Vegas, and her report is presented by Samantha Early.
The Colorado River runs through a number of dry states in the southwestern U.S., Utah, Arizona, Nevada, California, and all the way to Mexico, supplying over 40 million people with water. But the seasons here have become drier. Temperatures have increased, and there is less snowfall in the Rocky Mountains, an important source of water for the Colorado River. This powerful river is also being drained more quickly than it can replenish. One of the thirstiest cities along the Colorado River is Las Vegas. It's a man-made oasis in North America's driest desert. Without Lake Mead, which is fed by the Colorado, the 2 million people here would struggle to survive. Las Vegas has enormous hotels with thousands of rooms, lush fountains, spacious pools and rich green golf courses. Nothing in this gambling city indicates that water is precious or running short. But behind the scenes, the people who make this city run are hard at work.
We are just in the final phases of a $13 million renovation to implement this more water-efficient equipment, and it uses about 0.4 gallons of water per pound.
Eric Brady is the president of Brady Linen, one of the largest laundry shops in Las Vegas. Brady's company washes 450 tons of laundry each day, servicing the city's main hotels, restaurants and entertainment centres. But they've traded in their traditional washing machines for low-consumption systems. The new equipment reduces their water use by 8 million litres per day. One of Brady's customers, the hotel group MGM Resorts, is also trying to reduce energy and water consumption. Cindy Ortega is MGM Resorts' Senior Vice President. She explains that they have installed 10,000 low-water showers in an effort to reduce the strain on local water resources.
And what it did was it delivered less water per minute. It delivered under 2 gallons a minute for what we thought was the same experience for the guest. So the guest didn't feel like that it was a reduced experience from the shower he or she might take at home, when in fact it really was.
The hotel group says new technology will help them save 190 million litres of water each year. In addition to making their hotels more sustainable, a reduction in water consumption also softens costs. All that water comes with a pretty hefty price tag. Another huge strain on the Colorado River are the recreation facilities in Las Vegas, like this golf course. There are over 60 courses here, and given that this is a desert, a lot of water goes into keeping them plush. To make golf possible in the desert, the dusty soil has to be irrigated with the same amount of water that California's Imperial Valley requires to grow winter vegetable crops. Dale Hahn is the greenskeeper at one of the city's golf centres. He admits that there are too many courses in Las Vegas, but they draw tourists and are a big moneymaker. Hahn insists that golf has its positive sides.
We're more than just a water user. We're a wildlife habitat and a great recreation area for our golfers.
Hahn says only a small portion of the course, 20%, gets sprinkled with drinking water. The rest receives grey water, which is wastewater from sinks and showers. The water is processed and delivered by a small factory right next to the golf course. Still, a typical 18-hole round golf course in Las Vegas requires 9,500 litres of water each day to keep it green. That's a quarter of what a US family uses in a month. At the local waterworks, Doug Bennett says he doesn't want to discourage golf courses, hotels and other businesses. They bring important revenue into the city. But he does think locals could be more responsible in their water consumption.
What is a waste, though, is using a highly thirsty plant for nothing more than ornamental purposes.
Bennett says that in 2012, private households were responsible for 60% of water consumption in Las Vegas. What he doesn't like to see is household water waste, so he's offering a little incentive.
People who transform their lawns into water-smart gardens will get a bit of cash, about 12 euros per square metre. Amy Zeldenrust's lush garden has already won. When she moved into her house, Zeldenrust immediately replaced the lawn and turned it into a wild orchard.
I have almond trees, I have pear trees, I have fig trees, lemons, lime. But it's very Mediterranean palette with a lot of succulents and, you know, agaves, aloes, South African and desert things mixed in.
Most of these trees are made for Las Vegas's dry, hot conditions. They don't need water every day, which means Zeldenrust isn't pouring precious drinking water into her garden. She points at the sad-looking magnolia across from her house and shakes her head. She says many residents have moved to Las Vegas from the cooler east and plant what they are familiar with back home, even if these plants need more water. Back at the city's casinos, environmentalist Rob Mrovka says lack of local action is exactly the problem.
Las Vegas is improving, but it's not doing a great job of water conservation.
Right now, per capita consumption here is 830 litres per day. But it's 540 litres per day in San Francisco, and just 160 litres in other large cities like London and Singapore. Mrovka wants stricter water regulations to be put in place.
The Southern Nevada Water Authority has a goal in one of their plans that says by the year 2030, we want to reduce the water per capita use down to 199.
But will low water washing machines and reduced consumption at golf courses be enough to tackle the problem here? The Colorado River's levels are continuing to drop. In fact, if consumption doesn't come down drastically within the next year or two, this entire region may end up in a state of emergency. That means water supply for Nevada, Arizona, and even Mexico will be cut off, leaving the lawns and golf courses brown, the laundry unwashed, and the showers switched off. It would most likely leave Las Vegas, a city which uses river water to cover almost all of its water needs, looking a lot more like the desert city it really is.
Samantha Early there presenting a report by Christina Bergman. What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, and so we're going to move back to Europe for our last report this week. Two of the world's great rivers, the Orange Senku in southern Africa and the Danube in central Europe, are both facing big environmental challenges. Both rivers cross numerous borders, and both have international commissions to manage them. Recently, those two organizations have decided to work together to solve their rivers' environmental issues. To find out how that's working out, Kerry Skyring joined a Danube river expedition taking off from the Austrian capital Vienna.
The research ship Istros is heading down the Danube. Slowly, the high-rise buildings of the Austrian capital, Vienna, slip away, and the banks are soon lined with holiday huts and river forest. On board, scientists and environmentalists are busy with microscopes and water samples. And looking on are visitors from Africa who've come to see how Europe looks after one of its biggest rivers.
Because we're from different countries, I'm from South Africa, Namibia and Botswana. So the person was actually...
These guests here today are from South Africa, Lesotho, Botswana and Namibia. They've journeyed to the Danube because they work for the commission managing the Orange Senku River Basin. Their mandate is similar to that of the International Commission for the Protection of the Danube River, namely cross-border coordination and protection of water quality. The two river commissions signed a cooperation agreement back in 2008, a project which was brought to life by the German government. Rapula Pula is a South African water resources specialist working on the Orange Senku River. The problems he experiences in his daily work are very different to the issues experienced here on the Danube.
Basically, it's soil erosion because of the steep gradients, the altitude is very high there, then high velocities of water after it has rained, and then, of course, something also due to land use practices, for example, overgrazing, a means of livelihood for people in that part of the basin. Coming down, some of the challenges include increasing demands for water and, you know, challenging management of the used water. or the wastewater, a little bit of a challenge with pollution.
In fact, on the surface, the two rivers don't seem to have a lot in common. Although they are both well over 2,000 kilometres and also cross multiple international borders, according to Rapula, it's the many differences between the two rivers which make this cooperation work. He says his team has areas of expertise that scientists on the Danube are lacking.
Water scarcity, the Orange Single River Commission has more experience with regard to that, because that's the main challenge compared to the Danube River Basin, where water scarcity is not necessarily really a big issue. So the other issue is also drought management, because this is a main challenge for us, you know, being in a semi-arid to arid climatic conditions.
One common problem, though, for both rivers is pollution. More than half the length of the Orange Senku River runs through South Africa. Industry activity and big agricultural farms can hit water quality in the river hard. According to Igor Lischka, technical expert at the Danube Commission, the same applies to the Danube.
You may recall a couple of years ago this red sludge accident. The material in Hungary which got into the rivers was primarily just caustic, alkaline. So it was not like heavily toxic material, but the problem was that it was a huge amount of that material.
Both river commissions say there's no alternative to international bodies like theirs when it comes to managing and conserving the rivers. But the big question is, do these commissions really have the clout that they should have, especially when it comes to conservation?
And I found that they are pretty good when it comes to water quality, you know, because nobody likes dirty water. There's an easy agreement saying we need to be cleaner.
Ulrich Eichelmann is a freshwater specialist and founder of the Vienna-based NGO Riverwatch. He thinks the environmental record of the Danube River Commission, at least, could be better.
When it comes to real ecosystem, to protection of certain stretches, if it comes to fight against the navigation lobby, for example, they want to channelize the Danube, then it's difficult. Then my overall result would be, yes, they're in the discussion, they're giving us the space, but they're not a big lobby.
Two rivers, two continents. Participants here on board agree that the most important thing about their work together is the focus it puts on seeing rivers in their entirety. Because rivers aren't just a place for water to flow, they say. What is done to a river affects the shoreline, birds and animals, and of course the people downstream. Kerry Skyring, DW, Vienna, Austria.
And that report wraps up this week's special water edition of Living Planet. Don't forget you can have another listen to the reports you heard on the show by visiting our website at dw.de/environment. From me, Andreas Ilmer, and the rest of the team, thanks for listening, and why not tune in again next week? Living Planet comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany. Água de beber, água de beber, camarada. Água de beber, água de beber, camarada. Eu sempre tive uma certeza que só me deu desilusão. É que o amor é uma tristeza, muita mágoa demais para um coração. Água de bebê, camará, água de bebê, camará, água de bebê, camará, água de bebê, camará. Casa bem aberta, abre todas as portas do coração. Água de beber, água de beber, camarada. Água de beber, água de beber.